A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Every festival stage you've ever stood in front of, every construction site you've walked past, every serious workshop with machines that could take your finger off, they all have one thing in common. A chunky blue plug that looks like it belongs on a submarine. And most people have never touched one.
The IEC 60309 connector, also called the CEE form, also called the commando socket. And it is genuinely one of those pieces of infrastructure that's everywhere and invisible at the same time.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about the Commando Connector ecosystem. What equipment is actually available from suppliers, flood strips, extenders, waterproof variants? And the bigger question underneath, why someone would re-terminate an entire workshop around this standard instead of just using whatever outlets came with the building?
The timing on this is actually interesting, because we're at this inflection point where the commando socket is crossing over from pure industrial into what you might call prosumer territory. Hobbyists running three-phase CNC machines, people setting up portable solar arrays, even the early wave of EV charging infrastructure. A lot of it used 32-amp red, three-phase 60309 before the Menikes Type 2 connector became standard.
Plus, anyone who's tried to pull 32 amps through a domestic Schuko plug has probably already learned why that's a bad idea, usually involving melted plastic and a lingering smell of regret.
The thing is, most people in the maker and workshop community know the blue plug exists. They've seen it. But they don't know the ecosystem around it, what's actually on the shelf, what the variants mean, what the traps are. So by the end of this, you'll know exactly which 60309 variant to spec for your use case, and what gear exists to build a complete system from the wall to the tool.
We should probably start with what this thing actually is, because calling it the blue plug is like calling a diesel locomotive the loud train. There's a whole taxonomy here.
Let's talk about what IEC 60309 actually is. It's a global standard for industrial plugs, sockets, and couplers. And the specification is defined by three things working together: pin arrangement, keyway position, and color coding. The color isn't decorative. It's the first layer of a safety system.
When I see a red one versus a blue one, that's not a branding choice. That's voltage information.
Blue means 100 to 130 volts or 200 to 250 volts single phase. Red means 380 to 480 volts three phase. Yellow is 100 to 130 volts, three-phase. You almost never see that outside specific industrial sites. Green is 50 volts, safety extra low voltage. Orange is 60 volts. Black is 500 volts, mining equipment territory.
The most common ones in the wild are the 16-amp blue single-phase and the 16-amp or 32-amp red three-phase. Those two cover probably 90% of what a serious hobbyist or small workshop would ever touch.
The name Commando, where does that actually come from? It goes back to the original British military specification, BS-4343. This connector design was developed for NATO field equipment, generators, mobile command posts, field hospitals. It needed to be rugged, weatherproof, and quick to connect in the dark with cold hands. When the IEC eventually formalized it as 60309, the nickname had already stuck permanently.
Which explains the design language. It looks like something designed to survive being thrown off the back of a truck in a rainstorm, because it was.
That brings us to why it looks so different from a Schuko or a NEMA plug. The housing is thick impact, resistant nylon or rubber. The pins are substantial. On a 32-amp connector, the phase pins are about 6 millimeters in diameter. And there's a mechanical locking ring that you twist to secure the connection. A domestic plug would pull out under tension. A commando connector stays connected even if the cable is under serious strain.
The earth pin, it's longer than the others. That's the first make, last break design.
The earth pin protrudes further, so when you insert the plug, the earth connection is established before the phase and neutral pins make contact. when you disconnect the phase and neutral brake first and the earth is the last to separate. The equipment is grounded before it's energized and stays grounded until after it's de-energized. For anything with a metal chassis, that's a non-negotiable safety requirement.
Domestic plugs don't do this consistently. Some Schuco plugs have slightly longer earth clips, but it's not guaranteed, and the tolerance is loose enough that you can partially insert a plug and have live pins exposed with no earth connection.
The other differentiator is the IP rating. When mated, a standard 60309 connector is IP44, protected against water splashing from any direction. The IP67 versions can handle temporary submersion. A domestic plug in the rain is a short circuit waiting to happen. A commando connector in the rain is Tuesday.
The keyway system. You mentioned 17 different positions. That's the physical encoding that prevents voltage mismatches.
The keyway is a notch on the connector collar that lines up with a corresponding tab on the socket. A blue single-phase plug has its keyway in a different angular position than a red three-phase plug. They are mechanically incompatible. You cannot force a 230-volt device into a 400-volt socket. The plug simply won't seat.
Which is the kind of idiot-proofing that feels almost aggressive, until you remember that the alternative is someone plugging a 230 saw into 400 volts and turning the motor into a fragmentation grenade.
Within each color, the amperage determines the pin size and spacing. A 16-amp blue plug has smaller pins and a different pin circle diameter than a 32-amp blue plug. So you also can't plug a 16-amp device into a 32-amp circuit. The system encodes voltage, phase count, and amperage all mechanically.
The whole thing is a physical safety interlock system that also happens to conduct electricity.
It's worth noting that the standard is global. The same red 5-pin 32-amp plug works in Germany, the UK, Australia, Singapore. It's one of the few electrical standards that cross borders without fragmenting into regional variants.
Which is probably why it's become the default for temporary power distribution at international events. A touring band's lighting rig uses the same connectors whether they're playing in Berlin or Barcelona.
We've covered what the standard is and why it exists. Let's get into the equipment Daniel was asking about. The three categories every electrical supplier stocks. And I want to start with flood strips, because the name is misleading and the internals are where most people's understanding breaks down.
Sounds like something you'd deploy during a hurricane. Not something that lives in a workshop corner distributing power to your bench grinder.
The name comes from floodlighting. These were originally designed to distribute power across lighting rigs on film sets and construction sites. A flood strip is essentially a rugged enclosure, metal or heavy-duty polycarbonate, with one three-phase input and multiple outputs. The classic configuration is a 32-amp 5-pin red input feeding, 4 or 6 16-amp blue single-phase sockets.
You run one thick cable from the wall to this box, and suddenly you've got half a dozen regular outlets. But internally, it's not just a power strip with chunkier plastic.
No, and this is the part people get wrong constantly. It's not a parallel bus bar where every outlet gets all three phases. A proper flood strip takes the incoming phases, L1, L2, L3, plus neutral and earth, and distributes them across the outputs to balance the load. Outlet 1 gets L1 and neutral. Outlet 2 gets L2 and neutral. Outlet 3 gets L3 and neutral. Then it repeats. So on a 6-outlet strip, each phase feeds exactly 2 sockets.
Which means if you're not paying attention to which outlet you're plugging into, you could accidentally put 2 heavy loads on the same phase while the other 2 phases are barely working.
That's exactly the trap. Picture a woodworker with a 3-phase dust collector plus a single-phase table saw pulling 3 kilowatts and a single-phase air compressor pulling 2 kilowatts. If the table saw and the compressor both end up on L1 because you plug them into outlets 1 and 4 without checking, that phase is suddenly pulling 22 amps. L2 and L3 might be at 4 amps each. Nothing trips if the breakers are 16 amp per phase, but you're overloading one leg.
The fix is labeling, which costs about $3 for a label maker cartridge, and yet somehow almost nobody does it.
The better fix is what the good flood strips include, individual RCBOs per outlet. Each 16-amp blue socket gets its own dedicated protection, typically a C-curve, 16-amp RCBO. So if your compressor seizes and pulls 30 amps, it trips its own breaker and nothing else in the workshop goes dark.
versus the cheap $80 Amazon special that has one master breaker and maybe a single RCD, where one fault takes down your lights, your dust collector, and the CNC job that's been running for 3 hours.
That's the nightmare. You're 40 minutes into a complex carve, someone's compressor kicks in with a locked rotor, and suddenly your spindle stops mid-cut. The workpiece is scrap, the end mill might be embedded in it, and you're standing there in the dark.
The individual RCBO per outlet isn't a luxury feature. It's the difference between a distribution system and a liability.
Some of the higher-end flood strips also include a phase rotation indicator, a little light that confirms L1, L2, L3 are in the correct sequence. That matters for three-phase motors. If the phase rotation is reversed, your dust collector runs backwards. For something like a table saw with a screw-fed waste extraction, reversed rotation can jam the whole thing.
All right, what about the second category? The extenders. Because I've seen those bright blue cable reels everywhere and always assumed they were just extension cords with a fancy plug on the end.
The construction is completely different from a domestic extension reel. A proper 60309 extender uses HO7 RNF rubber cable, heavy-duty rubber-sheathed flexible cable. Oil-resistant, UV-resistant, stays flexible down to minus 25 Celsius. The conductors are 1.5 or 2.5 millimeter squared cross-section, depending on whether it's a 16-amp or 32-amp reel.
Not the 1mm PVC stuff that goes stiff as a board the first time it sees winter and cracks after a summer in the sun.
The connectors are either molded directly onto the cable or hardwired with screw terminals and a compression gland for strain relief. Common lengths are 10 meters, 25 meters, and 50 meters. The 16-amp blue reel is the workhorse of every construction site and outdoor event.
Most of them have a thermal cutout button, which I've learned to hate.
That's the derating trap. The thermal cutout is designed to trip if the cable overheats, which happens when you're pulling high current through a coiled cable because the coils create inductive heating. The problem is, most 16-amp reels with thermal cutouts will trip at around 10 amps continuous when the cable is fully coiled.
You've got a 16-amp plug and a 16-amp socket, but you can only pull 10 amps unless you unspool the entire reel, which nobody does. Everyone pulls out exactly as much cable as they need and leaves the rest coiled on the drum.
Then they curse at the thermal cutout and assume the reel is defective. The fix is trivial. Unspool it completely. But in practice, almost nobody does it. It's a user behavior problem that engineering can't fully solve.
The lesson is, if you're buying a 16-amp blue reel, either budget for the good one or budget for the time to unspool 50 meters of rubber cable every time you want to use your circular saw.
Or buy a 25-meter reel and accept that you'll need to unspool it fully for anything above 10 amps. The 50-meter ones are the worst offenders because nobody wants to handle 50 meters of 2.5 millimeter rubber cable if they don't have to.
All right, the third category, waterproof versions. What's the actual difference between an IP44 connector and an IP67 one when you're holding them in your hands?
The IP67 version has a rubber gasket seated in a groove on the mating face, and the locking ring is designed to compress that gasket when you tighten it. When properly mated, it can withstand submersion in 1 meter of water for 30 minutes. The trade-off is that the rubber boot and gasket make the connector physically bulkier, and in cold weather the rubber stiffens and the connector becomes noticeably harder to mate.
It's waterproof, but only if you can actually get it plugged in, which in January, with frozen fingers, might be a genuine struggle.
There's an interoperability detail that catches people out. An IP67 plug can mate with an IP44 socket. The plug's gasket will compress against the socket face, but the overall connection is only IP44 because the socket housing isn't sealed to the same standard. The reverse is worse. An IP44 plug and an IP67 socket breaks the seal entirely. The IP67 socket relies on the plug's gasket to complete the waterproofing, and an IP44 plug doesn't have one.
The waterproof rating is a negotiation between the two halves, and it defaults to whichever one is weaker, which feels like a metaphor for most engineering compromises.
It really does. All right, so we've walked through the equipment ecosystem, flood strips, extenders, waterproof variants, and at this point, someone listening is probably thinking, this sounds great, I'm going to re-terminate my entire workshop this weekend. And that's where we need to talk about the standardization trap.
Because for every beautifully wired workshop with color-coded commando sockets marching across the walls in perfect formation, there's someone with a drawer full of adapters and a deep sense of regret.
Three failure modes in particular. The first is overspecification. You put a 32-amp red socket on the wall for a bench grinder that pulls maybe 10 amps on a bad day. The socket works fine, but you've just spent $50 on a connector for a $100 tool. Worse, someone visiting your shop sees that 32-amp socket and assumes the circuit behind it is rated for 32 amps. They plug in something heavy. The grinder's internal wiring, which was never designed for more than 10 amps, becomes the fuse.
The socket rating implies a capacity that the tool doesn't have, and the breaker won't protect the tool's internal wiring because it's sized for the circuit, not the device.
The breaker protects the cable in the wall. It has no idea what's connected at the other end. With a 32-amp commando socket, the ceiling is high enough to melt things that were never meant to see that kind of current.
Failure batter number two is the one I've personally witnessed, the adapter drawer of shame. You standardize your whole shop on commando sockets, and then a friend brings over the thickness planer with a Schuko plug, or you buy a used oscillating sander that still has its original domestic cord. Suddenly, you need an adapter. Then you need another one. Then one gets borrowed and never returned. Then you buy a cheap one online that turns out to have undersized wire and no strain relief.
That cheap adapter becomes the failure point. I've seen CEE form to Schuko adapters where the Schuko end was molded from plastic so brittle it cracked after three uses, leaving live pins exposed. You've built this beautiful, robust distribution system, and then you hang a $2 adapter off the end of it.
It's like building a vault door and then leaving the key under the mat.
The third failure pattern is voltage confusion, and this one is dangerous in mixed environments. A blue 16-amp socket in Europe is 230 volts. That same blue 16-amp socket in North America is 125 volts. The color code is consistent globally, but the voltage behind the socket depends entirely on local wiring.
If I import a European bandsaw with a blue 16-amp plug and plug it into a blue 16-amp socket in a US workshop, it fits perfectly. The color matches, the keyway matches, and the saw runs at half voltage. Weak, probably won't cut anything, but it won't trip a breaker either. No indication that anything is wrong except the tool doesn't work.
The reverse is worse. Someone brings a 125-volt tool to a European workshop, plugs it into a blue socket expecting 125 volts, and gets 230. That one does trip something, usually the tool's internal fuse, if you're lucky. If you're unlucky, the motor windings.
The color code is a promise that the standard doesn't actually keep. It tells you the voltage range, but not which end of the range you're on.
That brings us to another distinction that most people miss entirely. There are actually two different IEC 60309 standards. 60309-2 is the pin and sleeve variant. That's the one everyone knows. But there's also 60309-1, which is the interlocked switched socket.
Interlocked meaning what, exactly?
It has a mechanical interlock that physically prevents you from inserting or removing the plug while the switch is in the on position. You have to turn the switch off before the plug can be inserted or removed. And conversely, you can't turn the switch on until the plug is fully seated and locked.
It's a built-in enforcement mechanism. No hot plugging, ever.
That matters enormously for inductive loads. Motors, transformers, anything with significant inrush current. If you disconnect a running three-phase motor under load by yanking the plug, the arc can weld the pins together. I've seen connectors that had to be cut off with an angle grinder because someone pulled a 32-amp plug while a compressor was running.
Most flood strips use the non-switch type, which is fine for resistive loads, heaters, lighting, but dangerous for motors if someone unplugs while the tool is running.
The interlocked version costs about twice as much, which is why you rarely see it in hobbyist setups. But for anything with a motor over about 2 kilowatts, it's not really optional. It's just that nobody tells you that when you're buying the components.
The invisible standard is the one that might actually save your connectors, and possibly your hands, from an arc flash.
Let me give you some real deployment patterns. In film and TV, the typical setup is a 63-amp 3-phase red 5-pin as the main feed from the generator. That goes into a distribution box that steps it down to 16-amp blue for the lighting rigs and 32-amp red for the HMIs, the big daylight balanced fixtures that pull serious power. The whole set runs on 60309 from the generator to the last light.
They're deploying and striking this stuff in the rain, in the mud, at 3 a.m, which is exactly the use case the standard was designed for.
EV charging is another one. Type 2, the Menikes connector, is the standard now for permanent chargers. But early public charging infrastructure and still a lot of temporary event charging use 32-amp red 3-phase 60309. You'll still see it at festivals and motorsport events where they need to deploy charging in a field for a weekend.
Alright, so we've got this ecosystem. But there's a market shift happening right now that changes the buying equation. You mentioned Chinese manufacturers driving prices down.
This is the part that doesn't get discussed enough. Since about 2020, manufacturers in Taizhou, a city in Zhejiang province that's become a hub for electrical connector manufacturing, have been producing 60309 clones. Menikes clones, Walther Work clones, PCE clones, and they've driven prices down by about 40%. A genuine Menikes 32-amp red plug retails for around $35. The Taizhou clone is $12. The pin walls are thinner, about 0.3 millimeters thinner on the clones I've seen tested. Under continuous 32-amp load, the genuine Menikes pins stabilize at about 55 Celsius. The clone pins hit 85. At 85 Celsius, the nylon housing starts to soften. Over repeated cycles, the pins can shift position inside the housing.
The connector literally starts to melt itself from the inside, and the first indication is probably when it welds itself to the socket.
The metallurgy is different. Genuine connectors use nickel-plated brass pins. The clones often use plain brass with no plating, or a nickel flash so thin it wears off after a dozen mating cycles. Once the nickel is gone, you've got bare brass exposed to moisture, and you get galvanic corrosion between the pin and the socket contact. Outdoor use accelerates this dramatically.
Which means the $12 connector that saved you $23 upfront turns into a $50 service call when it corrodes and trips the breaker, or a $500 tool repair when the ground path fails.
There was a test published last year by a German Electrical Safety Institute, the VDE, where they bought 63 commando connectors from online marketplaces, Amazon, eBay, AliExpress. 1 in 3 were counterfeit or failed to meet the standard. Some had earth pins that were shorter than the phase pins, which completely defeats the first make last break safety design.
1 in 3. That's not a lottery. I want to play with something that's carrying 32 amps at 400 volts in a room full of wood dust.
That brings us to the practical question. How do you actually do this right? We've covered the equipment, the failure pattern, the counterfeit problem. Let's land on what someone listening can actually do this weekend.
All right, actionable stuff. If I'm standing in my workshop right now, looking at a wall of mismatched domestic sockets, and I want to standardize on 60309 without making the mistakes we've just described, where do I start?
Start with the input. Run a 32-amp 3-phase supply to a central point in the workshop terminated in a red 5-pin socket. That gives you about 22 kilowatts of total capacity. From there, feed a flood strip with individual RCBOs per output.
The individual RCBOs are non-negotiable.
A Menikes or Walther Work flood strip with 4 or 6 individually protected 16-amp blue outputs will cost you maybe $150 to $200. It is the single best investment in the whole system. One tool fault takes down one outlet. Everything else keeps running. Your lights stay on. Your dust collector stays on. Your CNC job doesn't become a paperweight.
The RCBO should be a C-curve, not a B-curve, because motors have inrush current that'll nuisance trip a B-curve breaker.
C-curve handles 5 to 10 times rated current for the short duration of motor startup. B-curve will trip the moment your table saw spins up. That's a 30-second conversation with your electrical wholesaler that saves you months of frustration.
Second actionable thing, where to actually buy the connectors. Because the price difference is real, and the counterfeit risk is worse than most people realize.
Buy from a known distributor. RS Components, DigiKey, Mauser, Farnell, or your local electrical wholesaler. The kind of place that sells to electricians, not to people browsing for phone chargers. The price premium is 20 to 30% over marketplace prices, but you are buying traceability. If a connector fails, Menikes or Walther Worka will want to know about it, and the distributor can trace the batch number back to the factory.
A 1 in 3 counterfeit rate on marketplaces, based on that VDE test. That means for every 3 connectors you buy, statistically one of them is a fire hazard. The 20% premium at DigiKey starts to look like a bargain.
If you're buying in any quantity, say you're doing a full workshop rewire and you need a dozen connectors, call the distributor and ask for a trade account. You'll often get 10 to 15% off list price, which closes the gap with the marketplace prices but keeps you in genuine components.
Third thing, the waterproofing decision. You mentioned earlier that IP67 adds $5 to $8 per connector and makes them harder to mate in cold weather. When is it actually worth it?
If the connector lives outdoors or in an unheated space where condensation is a regular occurrence, spec IP67. The better seal doesn't just keep out puddles, it keeps out the fine dust that settles into an IP44 connector over months and eventually causes contact resistance. In a woodworking shop, that dust is conductive enough to cause tracking across the insulator face.
Even if you never plan to submerge your table saw plug, the IP67 seal is buying you contact life in a dusty environment.
The extra $5 to $8 per connector is paying for the gasket that keeps abrasive dust off the pin surfaces. Over 5 years, that's the difference between connectors that still mate smoothly and connectors that feel gritty and need deoxide tea sprayed into them every 6 months.
One last thing, something anyone can do this afternoon without buying anything. Check the color of every blue socket in your wood shop.
This is a good field test. The nylon housing on 60309 connectors contains UV stabilizers, but they degrade over time. If a blue socket has faded to pale blue or almost white, the stabilizers are gone. The housing has become brittle. It can crack under mechanical load, and when it cracks, you lose the IP seal and potentially expose live parts.
These things are often mounted outdoors or near open bay doors where they get sun every day. A 5-year-old socket that's been in direct sunlight might look fine from a distance, but up close it's chalky and faded.
A new 16-amp blue socket is $15. A cracked socket that arcs when you plug in your dust collector is not worth the gamble. And while you're at it, check the gasket in any IP67 connectors you already have. The rubber hardens and shrinks over time. If the gasket doesn't feel pliable, replace it. Most manufacturers sell gasket kits separately for a few dollars.
The weekend checklist. Check your existing sockets for UV fade. Spec a 32-amp 3-phase input with a proper flood strip. Buy from a real distributor and go IP67 for anything that sees dust or moisture. That's a system that'll outlast the tools plugged into it.
One thing we haven't said explicitly but runs through all of this, document your installation. Label every outlet with its phase and amperage. Draw a one-line diagram of what's connected where. Stick it inside the flood strip lid. The next person who works on it, which might be you in 5 years, having forgotten everything, will thank you.
Or the electrician you call when something goes wrong, who otherwise has to spend an hour buzzing out circuits to figure out which phase feeds which outlet.
That's the difference between a workshop electrical system and a workshop electrical system you can actually maintain. And it costs a Sharpie and a piece of paper. Here's the question I keep coming back to. We're at this weird moment where residential power is starting to look a lot like industrial power. Three-phase solar inverters are showing up in suburban garages. Heat pumps are pulling 16 amps continuous. Every new EV comes with a Menikes Type 2 port. And the commando socket, which was designed for construction sites and NATO field hospitals, is sitting right there as the obvious high-power residential standard. But is it actually going to win?
The Type 2 connector already has the install base. Every EV charger in Europe, every wallbox, every public charging station, that's millions of connectors in homes right now. The commando socket has workshops and festivals.
The Type 2 connector is smart in ways that 60309 isn't. It has data pins. It negotiates with the car before energizing. It can do load management. The charger talks to the house and says, "I'd like 32 amps, but I'll take 16 if the heat pump is running." A commando socket is just copper and plastic. It has no opinion about what's happening on the other phases.
Which is both its strength and its limitation. The commando socket doesn't need a firmware update. It doesn't have a handshake protocol. You plug it in, it works. But it also can't participate in the smart panel's load balancing. It's the dumb pipe of high power connectors.
That's where the revision to the standard gets interesting. The IEC 60309-2 standard is being revised, expected 2027 to add a data contact, a dedicated pin for load management communication.
Your next commando socket might literally talk to your smart panel. It becomes a participant in the house's energy management rather than just a passive outlet.
Which would close the gap with Type 2 in a pretty significant way. Imagine a flood strip in your garage that tells your solar inverter which outlets are drawing power and negotiates priority. The car charger gets 32 amps until the heat pump kicks in, then it throttles to 16. The commando socket goes from being the dumb industrial connector to being a node in a home energy network.
If that happens, the commando ecosystem has one big advantage over Type 2. It's not limited to vehicle charging. It's already the standard for every other high-power device. Welder, dust collector, compressor, kiln. Type 2 is a one-trick pony. It charges cars. 60309 with a data pin could be the universal high-power interface for everything in a house.
The question is whether the market cares enough to switch. Menikes, the company, not just the connector, already makes both. They're positioned to win either way. But the residential electrician who's been installing Type 2 chargers for 5 years isn't going to start recommending commando sockets for the heat pump unless there's a clear reason.
Standards wars are rarely won on technical merit. They're won on install base and installer familiarity. Right now, Type 2 has the momentum.
60309 has the range. It covers everything from a 16-amp blue single phase to a 125-amp black three-phase. Type 2 tops out at 63 amps three-phase in the latest spec, and almost nobody uses it above 32. If you need real power, an induction furnace, a big CNC spindle, a commercial kitchen, Type 2 isn't even in the conversation.
Maybe the answer is that they coexist. Type 2 owns the garage wall. 60309 owns the workshop and the utility room, and the data pin revision makes them interoperable at the panel level.
That's my bet. The house of 2035 has both. The car plugs into Type 2, the heat pump, the battery inverter, the backup generator input, those are on 60309, and the smart panel manages them all through a common load management protocol, regardless of which physical connector is on the other end.
Which is a long way from the muddy NATO field hospital where this whole thing started. But that's how infrastructure works. The connector designed for a diesel generator in the rain ends up in your basement managing your solar array.
That's it for episode 301. If you've got a commando socket horror story, melted pins, counterfeit connectors, the adapter drawer that ate your weekend, or a workshop standardization win you're proud of, send it to prompts at myweirdprompts.com.
We'd especially love to see photos of your distribution setups. The good ones, the bad ones, the ones held together with zip ties and hope.
Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop for keeping the lights on, presumably through a properly spec flood strip with individual RCBOs.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Find every episode at myweirdprompts.com.
Or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you've got 30 seconds, leave us a review. It helps other people find the show.
Now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
In the 1950s, a Faroe Islands radio technician accidentally discovered that wax phonograph cylinders, when left too close to a transmitter's cooling vent, would partially remelt and re-record fragments of the broadcast, effectively creating the world's first accidental magnetic tape loop decades after the cylinder era was supposed to be over.
Right.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore. A thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear. Until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.